For the record, a doppelganger is a living person's ghostly counterpart, or a person who bears a striking resemblance to another person. It comes from the German words for double and goer. And Neil McCormick is the doppelganger of U2's lead singer Bono, figuratively speaking anyway. McCormick grew up convinced that he was going to become a world-famous rock star. Unfortunately, it was his childhood friend Bono that became the world's biggest rock star instead. Neil McCormick's the author of Killing Bono, A True Story. McCormick told Steve Paulson about his old classmate, Bono.
I thought he was a rock star before he was a rock star. He was kind of a star in the school corridor. He was a very cool character. I don't think he was aware of this. And we've had these conversations later. And he thought that I was much cooler than he was because I suppose I was more the kind of guy that you would think. You know, I was a smart aleck. And, you know, I dressed in black and followed extreme bands and talked back to the teachers. Whereas Bono was a very friendly, sort of slightly goofy, slightly wild guy. But whether he knew it or not, he was much admired and much looked up to. You know, the charisma that took him through his next 30 years on stage was definitely present then. He was somebody that he always had a gaggle of girls or kids around him in the school corridor. And in fact, he was a year older than me, but we were still friends. That seemed to me that he was friends with everybody.
That's what I'm curious about, I guess, in this whole story, what it takes for someone to become a rock star. I mean, not just a star, but a mega star like Bono. I mean, is it charisma? Is it talent? Is it ambition? What is it that separates that person from all the other wannabes?
Well, that's the very thing that inspired me to write my book, Killing Bono, as it's called in the US. It has a different title in the UK, actually. It's called I Was Bono's Doppelganger, with the idea being that he lived my life. And I came to a few conclusions. Really, I think at the root of it is desire, is hunger. It's a kind of a black hole of absence, of needing love. And, you know, Bono's mother died when he was 13. I come from a very kind of secure family unit background, and I may have been creative and praised for my creativity and felt like I could achieve anything. But I don't think I had that motor, that engine of stardom that you find all across the board in show business, which is a kind of absence that motivates people. And Bono certainly had it.
Well, how did you feel as you had your own rock and roll band and it never was really taking off, and then here your classmates, the fledgling U2 band, was starting to become huge?
You know, I felt great about U2, partly because I was such a deluded teenage egotist that I never felt any rivalry with them. I believed it was my destiny to be famous. I was like one of these kids that queues up to be insulted by Simon Cowell on American Idol. And as much fun as I have about a show like that now, I always get a chill watching those queues of wannabes and realizing I would have been in there. And so I just thought we were, you know, things were taking a little longer for us, but the payoff would be enormous in the end. And they kind of kept on going. I think when they reached Wembley Arena, which was a big arena in London, I sort of thought, they've really turned out successful. And when they reached Wembley Stadium and we were playing Wembley Coach and Horses, of which I think there was 42 people in Wembley Coach and Horses and 80,000 people in Wembley Stadium, I realized that really we weren't in the race anymore. Then it became a little harder. Then I had to deal with things. Then I had to ask a question, you know, what's the difference between him and me? Do I have it? Does he have it? And I don't have it. I had a bit of an existential crisis, but I was nearly 30 by that time.
Well, the story that you tell in your memoir is very endearing. I mean, partly because you are the doppelganger here. I mean, you are the guy who didn't make it, the mirror image of what became of Bono. But you kept in touch with Bono. You've remained friends all of these years, and you have some great stories about him. And for instance, I guess it was fairly early on in his career, through Bono, you met Bob Dylan, right?
Yes, met is maybe stretching it a little too far. Bono certainly met him. In the story of my life with Bono, I tend to get left just on the edge of the VIP enclosure. And that was what happened then. Bob Dylan was playing a concert, a huge open air concert in Dublin. And I bumped into Bono backstage, and he had been invited to meet Bob Dylan. This was about 1985 or thereabouts, maybe even earlier. And Bono didn't actually know that much about Bob Dylan. He's an incredible bluffer, Bono. And I was a huge Dylan fan, so he asked me to come back and meet Dylan. But I didn't get into the Winnebago that was parked backstage. You know, I got held at the door while Bono was, you know, ushered into the inner sanctum. But later on, I was standing chatting with Alison, Bono's wife, and a couple of guys I had met there who I had no idea who they were. And this old guy just came and sidled up alongside us and stood around for a while. And it took me about 5 minutes, I think, to realize it was Bob Dylan. He looked so old. Shockingly, I've worked out that he's about the age that I am now. He had a lot of makeup on and he seemed kind of stoned. And Bono had turned up by this time and he put his arm around Bono and he's going, let's get our picture taken here. And I turned to the people that I was with that I'd been chatting to and I just said, he's so stoned. He's going to go on stage like that. He's such a disappointment. I said, you should never meet your heroes. Whereupon I got a swift kick in the ankles from Bono's wife because it turned out the people I was talking to were Bob Dylan's sons. But that was an amazing day for another reason as well, because Dylan asked Bono to go and sing with him on stage. And he had said to Bono something like, do you know Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat? And Bono had to confess that he didn't know Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat. And so Dylan said, well, you know, Stuck Inside a Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. And Bono had to confess that he didn't know Stuck Inside a Mobile. So Dylan, in exasperation, said, well, you must know Blowing in the Wind. So Bono asserted that, yes, of course he knew Blowing in the Wind, and he would do Blowing in the Wind. So when Dylan went on stage, Bono turned to me and said, do you know the words to Blowing in the Wind? Which he duly tried to memorize before going on stage and miserably failed. Went on stage in front of 200,000 unreconstructed Irish hippies, and Dylan sang the first verse in the chorus, and then it was, ladies and gentlemen, Bono, whereupon Bono stood up on stage and started singing, you know, the first thing that came into his head and extemporizing lyrics. How many times must the barbed wire stretch across our divided land? And just anything that came into his head, which was going rather well, actually, because Bono's quite good at extemporizing, until the band went into the chorus, the answer, my friend, and Bono, not even knowing there was a chorus there, was still singing, how many times, and just had to sort of go, how many times, and Dylan gave him a look that I will never forget, at which point Bono wisely shut up and let Dylan finish the song.
And what did Dylan make of that by the end? Did he forgive Bono?
You know, I met Jacob Dylan many years later, who was one of the boys who I had insulted his father to, and we laughed about the incident, and I asked him about that, and he said, you know, Dad still has a good laugh about that at the dinner table. Bono apparently apologized to Bob when they got to know each other a bit better later on, apologized to Bob for making up new lyrics to his songs. And Dylan said, don't worry about it. I do it all the time.
Now, it's worth pointing out that you work as a rock critic. And in fact, you often write about U2. But it does make me wonder if your life, if your career might be a little bit easier if you didn't always have Bono's shadow hanging over you.
It's a question, isn't it? My career as a rock critic has probably been made easier by having Bono's shadow, because he's a great contact to have and a great source for a story. Would my life have been easy? You know, I went to school reunion. It was a class reunion. It was a few years ago. Bono didn't come along. You know, his wife Ali came because she was in our class as well, and The Edge came. And I did have this moment of thinking to myself, I have a column in Britain's biggest selling sort of broadsheet newspaper, and I am fairly regularly on television and radio. And in probably any other circumstances, I would probably have been the most visibly successful person to have come out of that particular class in school, except I happened to go to school with Bono, and your achievements are rather blighted. I said to Bono afterwards, I spoke to him the next day, and I said, why didn't you go to the class reunion? He said, you know, he was afraid that he would have imbalanced the whole thing because, you know, people saying, well, what have you been doing for the last 25 years? But we know what he's been doing. He's sold, you know, hundreds of millions of records, and he's, you know, saved the world from itself, and he's met the Pope and the President and And then he says to you, what have you been doing? Well, put up some shelves.
Do you still wish you had had Bono's life? I mean, if you could trade places with him, would you?
Yeah, wouldn't you? You know, Bono has had the greatest life. There's lots of people whose life I wouldn't trade places with. You know, you could have gone to school with practically any rock star, and I'd have probably said, oh, no, you know, who wants that? You know, who wants their coke habit or their seven wives or those terrible haircuts they endured? But, you know, Bono has lived a really full life. I wouldn't want to be Bono because I think that he is constantly moving because he's trying to fill up that emptiness that I just didn't have. You know, I had a very good relationship with my parents. But I wouldn't mind living in his house. I mean, you should see his house.
Neil McCormick talking about his book Killing Bono, a true story. Or as it's called in the UK, I Was Bono's Doppelganger. McCormick spoke with Steve Paulson. And it seems that McCormick's old dream of becoming a world-famous rock star is not quite dead yet.
By some weird twist of fate, long after I had resigned myself to a life of failure and obscurity, and after I had practically finished writing a book about being a loser, that was its selling point. Bono was the winner and I was the loser in that book. Right at the end of that process, I got a call from Mel Gibson to ask if he could use one of my songs on an album called Songs Inspired by the Passion of the Christ. And it duly came out with my song sandwiched between Elvis Presley and Leonard Cohen, Bob Dylan bringing up the rear.
Pretty good company, I have to say.
Very good company, and I should just retire now before I go and mess it all up completely.
I know you heard me. Think this ain't working. You're down on your knees, begging me please, but it won't go away. I hear you crying. I know you've been trying.
That's The Ghost Who Walks, also known as Neil McCormick, with a song called Harm's Way from the album Songs Inspired by the Passion of the Christ.